Okay, and so we're going to focus in today, Exodus chapter 32, the worship of the golden calf. We're going to leave a little bit of the end of chapter 32 until next week because the end of chapter 32 and 33 belong together, and we'll do, that next week. But it's been an interesting little series of rabbit trails since. Basically, since chapter 20, we never can figure out where Moses is. All of a sudden, he's on top of the mountain, then he's not, then he's up on top of the mountain again. And guess what? He's going to be on top of the mountain again today. And so it's obvious, and it's obvious to scholars as well, that our author is not trying to create a newspaper article. He's not trying to say, here's exactly what happened. Here's the linear time frame that things happened in. The way that it's structured, it basically produces a theological message. And we'll talk more about that next week. But for now, we've gone through the tabernacle, the building of the furniture, the ark, all everything that needs to be done, and we're actually ready to build everything. We're ready to put the tabernacle together, to build the furniture, get it all going. But we're going to get interrupted here, and so basically, that's where we're at. And Moses, at this point, is up on the mountain, and it's obvious that the people had no idea, how long he was going to be there. And, it could be stated that nor did Moses know how long he was going to be there. And this length of time that he's there on the mountain is causing issues down at the foot of the mountain. So let me read that section of scripture for us, and then we'll jump into the study. So, Exodus chapter 32, beginning in verse 1. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know where what has become of him." So Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold that are in your ears, in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord," which that word is Yahweh. And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves, and they have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf, and have worshipped it, and sacrificed to it, and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I might make a great nation of you." But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, "O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'With evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, 'I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever.' And the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing on his people. Praise God for his word. What a story.
No kidding.
What a story.
But why would Aaron do that? He was a priest.
I know. Okay, well, we'll talk about all those things. So, you know, we have four major groups, people/groups in the scene here. We have the people in general. We have the Levitical priesthood headed by Aaron. We have Moses and God up on top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's, you know, so Aaron and all the people are on the foot of the mountain, far enough away where they're not going to die. And then Moses and God are, you know, intimate up on top of the mountain in very close proximity of each other, dealing with the commandments, the Ten Commandments. As a matter of fact, as you know, as Moses comes down, he's got the two tablets, one in each hand, as he's coming down. Okay, so now I'm going to kind of zero in on a few things that I think are very interesting, and not deal with the typical things that you hear about this. You know, it is funny. And it makes for a good sermon when Aaron says, "Hey, you know, I just took all this stuff, threw it in the fire, and look, out jumped this calf." Yeah, that is funny, and you know, it's interesting, and you know, the pastor or the person preaching the sermon will explain to you just how easy it is to sin and all this kind of stuff. But you know, I suppose rightfully so. But there's a lot more here that we really need to pay attention to, as opposed to, you know, just the surfacey sort of things that have to deal with, you know, how we sin today. Because this is the people of Israel moving away from apparently what God has told them. Because again, remember, Moses is up on top of the mountain. He's got the Ten Commandments in his hand at this point. But somehow, some way, these Israelites are supposed to know, don't make a graven image. Okay? But, you know, chronologically speaking, that commandment's up there. We haven't read that yet. Okay? So, you know, let's kind of march our way through some of this stuff. So, again, some of the commentators that Heiser uses and you know, I think are top-notch too, Sarna is one of them, and he says this: "The account of the tabernacle is interrupted by the story of making and worshiping the golden calf." And so, if this is theological imaging, okay, if this is a literary structure that's trying to give you a theological message, then what we want to do is look at it and say, well, what is that message? And how is the author actually projecting that message to us? Because it doesn't make sense the way this is all chopped up. It doesn't make sense to have Moses up on top of the mountain and all of a sudden he's not. And then he's back up there again and all of a sudden he's not. So something's happening. And, you know, for the uneducated village atheist, this is where they say, oh, look, you know, the Bible's not reliable. I mean, you know, the author doesn't even know where Moses is, let alone, you know, what he's doing or anything like that. No, you know, there's a lot of things about literature that's written in this time period that are foreign to us. You know, obviously, number one, you know, the numbers that we've been looking at all along, they're not used for fact-checking. They're used to make a statement of greatness or, you know, they're not used to say, oh, yeah, there was 100,000 people in this block, you know. That's not the way it works. Oftentimes, just like in this story, our author will use a literary structure that basically says, okay, this is the last thing that happened before it was created. And oh, by the way, all these things happen too. Because, you know, when you look at the fact that there's molten language, in this particular text when it comes to making this calf. You got to melt the gold. But and so how in the world would you use a tool on melted gold, molten metal, those kinds of things? But as you overlaid it, maybe the last thing you would do is score it and make it more defined. Who knows? But the point is, a lot of people, they look at the story, these kinds of stories, especially people who don't want the Exodus to be true, and say, look at this mess, But these are just literary techniques that are common for this kind of literature and that kind of, exegetical setting. And so we're not going to get tripped up by those kinds of things. But what we want to do is look at, how the author has separated these things, has put the details of instructions in a certain order, called literary arrangements, and how he's conveying the impression of the apostasy of the people at this point. That's what we're going to be looking at. The people have gone astray. And again, you can argue, I think, you can argue with a fair degree of confidence that, hey, the people don't know that I'm not supposed to have a graven image right now, okay? Now, there's things to look at, though, in Scripture that kind of lean the other direction, where it's like, just because you haven't received the written code on the tablets of stone, you should have known this all along, okay? Or you were told prior to this. It wasn't that, Moses came down and said, hey, look, you guys need to read this. You'd never seen this before. No, God had just inscribed it on tablets. No one ever said that you've never seen this before. Okay? You've never told this before. As a matter of fact, God oftentimes, when he's speaking about the people, he's saying that they've departed from what I've commanded them to do. And again, that connotation is here in this text as well. So, we'll look at all that. But, I think one of the most interesting things about the way our author has structured this is somehow he wants us to know that you have to build a tabernacle with clean hands. Okay? It's important. It's important that the tabernacle and the implements inside the tabernacle are built with clean hands. So just before we build it, we have this picture of this severe indiscretion of the people. Okay? I think that's where we're going. I think, that's what our author is actually causing us to see. Because, the instructions of the tabernacle and the physical building of the tabernacle bookend this story. Go ahead, Sharon.
So right now, in this, where we are, the tabernacle, they're building a tabernacle right at the foot of that mountain?
They haven't started yet. No.
Okay.
Not yet.
You're saying this is before they've received the instruction?
No. Well, this is, probably.
Okay.
Again, it's not in chronological order. It's in theological order.
Because Moses is still up on the mountain.
Yeah, he's still up on the mountain.
But they never said he went back up.
It's just he's still up there.
Right.
From, and he talked the Lord out of being angry and destroying people. Yet when Moses sees this, he gets very angry.
Mm-hmm. He does so, too. Yeah, that's right.
So I thought that was kind of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So, again, there's a lot of, there's a lot of pastoral... implements that are in this story. For instance, if I were your pastor and I was patting you on the head, I would say, now you see what happens when you're really close to God, like Moses was, and you see what happens when you were really far away, like the people were. Those kinds of things. And, I would say that, okay, that preaches. But again, I don't think that's what the author is really... is really conveying to us, because it all starts Exodus 24:18, when Moses goes up to the mountain into the cloud. Okay, so this is we're clear back in Exodus 24. Okay, and you know Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, and again, you know, did Moses know how long he was going to be there? Nothing in the text says that he knew it, but it does say that he was there for that long. And so, you know, we have the Israelites. They crossed the Red Sea. They've been following God all the way to Sinai. He's been in a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, whether it's daylight or whether it's dark. That's how they've actually seen God. We're visibly looking at God. Not only that, but both powers of heaven were with them for a while because, you know, the angel of the Lord was there as well. You know, and so we've got the whole family, and you know God is doing His thing. He's large and in charge. He's slaying the biggest army on earth at the time. I'm feeling pretty good, and I'm feeling pretty confident about my position with God and this whole trip. You know, I'm well funded. I've got gold in my pockets. I'm doing well. I'm pretty happy actually. And so now we make it all the way to Mount Sinai at this point. And this leader that we have called Moses, who just shows up out of nowhere and, you know, does his miracle, workings in front of our eyes, plus, you know, kind of controls the whole plague issue, defeating Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt, you know, he's with us too. So, you know, we've got God, we've got God's number one man, and, you know, I'm really feeling very good, very confident. But all of a sudden, God's gone, and His number one man is gone. Okay, and they've been gone for 40 days. And honestly, I mean, you know, here I am. Okay, so I'm at the foot of Mount Sinai right now, and God's up there. Although, even though I can tell He's up there, Moses is up there too. He's been gone for 40 days and 40 nights. He didn't take any water with him. He didn't take any food with him. You know, as far as I'm concerned, he's dead. And not just that, but, you know, God isn't close and intimate anymore. You know, I might be able to hear a peal of thunder and rumbling or whatever, but, you know, I'm not seeing Him anymore.
Could they see the fire?
I don't know. But the point is, the people felt very distant. They felt helpless because, you know, the guy who had the GPS system is gone. Okay? There's only one guy with a cell phone, and he's gone. So what do we need more than anything? We've got to have a cell phone. That's what we need. And I think that's what you're looking at here as far as the golden calf is concerned. So let's just kind of walk through that. I mean, that's the best way that I can explain it that, you know, a modern day American would kind of get it. Because you know how panicked you are when you forget your cell phone at home. Matter of fact, you'll be halfway, you know, you'll be halfway across town and turn around and go all the way back to get your cell phone. You won't go the rest of the trip, you know, because you're so afraid of not having that cell phone, you know, and so, you know, in a very real way, that's exactly what we're looking at here at the foot of Mount Sinai. Okay, so there's an article by a guy named Hunley, and it's an article from the Catholic Biblical Quarterly. It's entitled, "What is the Golden Calf?" It's a journal article, and you know, he says some interesting things that Heiser kind of presented. He says this about this topic. Exodus 24:18, what we said was Moses went up in the cloud, indicates that Moses stayed on the mountain 40 days, giving no indication that the people expected so long to stay and explaining their seemingly panicked reaction. So he's saying, these people had a good reason to panic. Chapter 32 continues the non-priestly narrative with Moses still on the mountain. The Israelites are alone in the wilderness with nothing to do and no idea where to go, with both God and guide nowhere to be seen. Apparently, in a state of panic, they construct a golden calf. either to concretely manifest Yahweh's presence or to replace Yahweh as God, and to replace Moses as God and go-between, or simply to render his role redundant. So, you know, this is an argument that scholars make, and there's scholars on both sides of the fence, because the interesting thing about the text, as you look at it, even if, as you look at it in Hebrew, the ambiguity you can cut with a knife. You can't tell what the people are thinking. I mean, you could go in any one of a number of directions as far as, you know, what, how the people are feeling and why they actually created the calf, and when they created the calf, what they thought the calf was. And I really do think that because the author could have zeroed in better, I think maybe what we're looking at here is the whole host of Israel felt differently about the calf. There was no such thing as carte blanche. Everybody, this is how we feel. And so
you think everybody went along with this?
No. I'm saying that I don't think so. But I'm saying that not everybody felt the same way about this calf. And mainly because, you know, so you'll read some scholars, and you know, just looking at the text, let me get back to the text here. Just looking at the text here. Let's see what you think, okay? When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, so there's the whole idea. We're scared, we're lost, we're lonely. That's clear. Make us gods. Okay, so now in the ESV translation, that word is G-O-D-S, plural, make us more than one God, right? But the Hebrew word here is Elohim. Okay, so it could either be singular or plural. Okay, make us gods who shall go before us. Okay, as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. So, Aaron's going to do that. But now, they're saying make us gods. Well, how many calves are there? There's only one. Okay, so now, you know, we have a mismatch already. And again, you know, it's ambiguous. It's like, well, what are they thinking? You know, what are they thinking they're doing?
They were used to many gods.
They were. It's true. Go ahead, Michelle.
However, the Elohim normally were represented by a figure here. Right, so they're saying, make us a figure that represents our God, because we don't have his presence with us and we need that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's right. And so, you know, the golden calf, I'm going to assert, in my final analysis, I'm going to assert that the golden calf is the cell phone. It is the channel by which they're trying to channel Yahweh back into their presence again. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty safe assumption, although not everybody's going to agree with that. But no matter what, and you know, I'll base that on a number of things. Number one, the text makes sure that, you know, in verse 13, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Remember the patriarchs. Okay, so now the people have been in Egypt for 400 years, yes, no question. And have they been influenced by Egyptian culture? Well, it would be ridiculous to say no. Of course they have. However, remember, now, you know, these are the Hyksos, okay? They're the Hyksos of you know, the I think it's the middle to later dynasties, where, you know, they were at times, the Hebrew people were at times viewed as kings of the Goshen area. They ruled the Goshen area, Okay. Because, I mean, and that certainly, that makes perfect sense, because when they first came, Pharaoh was absolutely head over heels in love with Joseph and everything he was doing, and giving Joseph anything he wanted, as Joseph was saving the whole world as far as they were concerned. And so when Jacob came, he even blessed Pharaoh, you know. So, I mean, they were large and in charge in this area. And they got to do what they wanted, and more than likely, because they were separated from the city structure and the educational structure of formal Egypt, they were still tried and true Hebrews, okay? And they knew, or they had no concept, I should say. They had no concept of idols, because Abraham didn't make idols, and Isaac didn't make idols. Jacob didn't make idols. The people around them did. Okay. And so, you know, I don't think that group of people would say, oh, let's make an idol. That's something God would be pleased with, because their fathers didn't do it. You know, as a matter of fact, we have the story about Jacob where, you know, he's leaving Uncle Laban and some of his gods are being taken, you know, with them. Who was it that took Rebekah? Took the gods. And, you know, they had to, those gods had to be buried, you know. And not only that, but we saw there in that story that they also had those earrings on.
That's what's bothering me. That's what I keep thinking.
Yeah, they also had those earrings on.
Yeah, who had the earrings?
The family of Jacob. So Jacob took the gods, Laban's gods, and the earrings, and he buried them under a tree. Remember that? And so, you know, we see from that these earrings that the people are wearing aren't just from, you know, they aren't just from, you know, the
what?
The mall.
Yeah, the mall.
Are they part of the plunder that they took from?
They are part of the plunder, but they are wearing them, and they are cultish.
They
are cultish. Yeah, exactly. They're religious by nature.
Okay. So, am I doing wrong when I?
No. You're not. But the point is, that's what they use them for, and also Gideon ran into this as well when he made the ephod and he took the earrings to do it, and it led the people astray. You know, so you know, this is something that isn't just from out of nowhere. If we've read the Bible, we understand that. And of course, if you study the culture, you'll understand it too. Anything in the ear and anything in the nose was religious in that time period. It was a cultish type thing, you know. And so naturally,
both women, sons, men, it was everyone
wearing. Right, was wearing them. That's right. So, you know, it, and that's the reason why they chose those, because they're cultish, you know, and that's what we'll make the idol out of. Okay. So that was kind of a rabbit trail, but you know, you do get the understanding that, you know, the people are on a trajectory right now, and they're doing it in very systematic fashion. It's not like this is just, you know, happening and just happen to fall into a problem, okay? But again, let's get back. You know, we're talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they really didn't have a concept in their lives about fashioning an idol to represent the God of Bethel, okay, Yahweh, okay. They didn't do that, and they knew better, and Jacob knew better, and, you know, Rebekah, because she was just so culturalized with, you know, her brothers and fathers, her family. She took the family gods with her, you know, and she shouldn't have done that. And so Jacob got rid of them. And so, Oh, sorry. Yeah, Rachel. I was going to say, Rebecca didn't sound right.
Right.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's Rachel. So, you know, make us gods who shall go before us. Okay, so the gods is Elohim. And so, you know, we have the question that's on the table. Do they believe it's Yahweh, or are they conjuring up some other gods? Because our God somehow has left us, so let's see if we can find another God. Or are we just saying that, well, you know, we need Yahweh, and we know from practical experience, this is how you channel a God. So that's kind of way, you know, kind of way we're going to talk about. Hunley goes on and he says about this: to understand the people's intentions in constructing the calf, we'll focus on two categories: which God is intended and what kind of image is intended. While the people's actions are relatively straightforward, their motives for and understanding of what they are doing remains relatively obscure. So you know, he's even saying it's ambiguous. You can't tell how the people were feeling and what they thought the calf was actually going to do for them. Just the way, and it's the way it's written. And most of the time when an author has the opportunity to zero in, laser focus on an issue and doesn't do it, it's because not everybody in the scene feels the same way. Okay. And you know that. I mean, even in this room right here, none of us feel exactly the same way about every passage in Scripture. None of us feel exactly the same way about Jesus. Not exactly, you know. And so it would be absurd to say that an entire nation, out of an entire nation of people, they all felt the same way about that calf, or Yahweh, or Moses, or anything else for that matter. You know, and so because the whole nation is involved here, I think our author isn't giving any specific details. It's just not, because not everybody in that crowd felt the same way.
But then when we have a relationship with God or through Jesus, doesn't he reveal himself to us all in different ways? I mean, isn't that a natural thing?
Well, I don't know about natural, but I do know it happens. So, okay, yeah, we'll use that word, natural, sure.
Well, no.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons why we don't feel the same way, you know. Our upbringing, culture, you know, all those kinds of things, you know. We're all different people from different backgrounds and different families and even different geographical areas.
And catechisms,
yeah, so... you know, it would be completely absurd to say that every person in that crowd felt exactly the same way. It doesn't even make sense. So he goes on, most notably regarding the identity of the deity whose presence they seek to manifest with the calf, and their use of Elohim seemingly in a plural. And he's saying seemingly in a plural. When they say, these are your gods, whether purposeful or not, the very thing serves the storyteller's purpose as it allows God, you know, the main storyteller, to condemn their actions regardless of their motivation. Now, that's his point. It doesn't make any difference what their motivation is. And there's many motivations in the crowd. God's condemning them all of them. Now, what does this say? Okay, so here's the pastoral part. You know, what does this say? Well, you know, you can't just worship God any way you want. Plain and simple. It doesn't make any difference about the motivation of your heart. Now, you're going to say, no, wait a minute, Mike. Hold on. Now, I've heard you say that just because the people didn't remember how to do Passover or weren't ready for Passover and some of those kind of things, God made exceptions because the motivation of their heart was right. That's true. In that direction, that's true. But in this direction, it's never true. Okay? In this direction, you can't say that this is who Jesus is to me, and I'm going to conjure up this image of him, and I'm going to relate to that image.
Oh, I got you.
You cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you can't do. That God does not approve of. And so I think that's probably one of the main theological points that our author is making, that there's, you know, there's the whole nation. He's not saying every single one of them was trying to get a hold of Yahweh. They had lost their cell phone. They built another one. Now they're trying to call him. He could have said that, but he didn't. He left it completely opaque. You just can't see what's going on. It's because nobody had the same motivation, or nobody felt exactly the same way. Now, we could go into a whole lot of ancient Near Eastern religious thought when it comes to a bull, bovine, you know, I mean, because when it comes right down to it, you know, everybody had the image of a bull in their religious system. Baal was a, well, because let's put it this way. Okay. Some people in the crowd thought the bull was Yahweh. Some people in the crowd thought the bull represented the things that Yahweh is. Okay. Some people in the crowd thought the bull was, well, just a God, standalone God, you know, all it's itself. But the point is that, you know, bulls have strength, they can defend, they have sexual prowess. I mean, they have all these things that, you know, you value. And so it's no wonder that, you know, every single people group in the ancient Near East, you know, had bull gods. The Apis bull in Egypt was, you know, paramount. I mean, as a matter of fact, you, in order to tell what dynasty you're digging in, they find the Apis bull steles, which are, you know, those granite tombstones that talk about the Apis bull of the time. And that actually allows them to date the dynasty and all. It's the Apis bull that actually, if it wasn't for all the documentation about Apis bulls, you'd never figure out the dynasties in Egyptian history. But they're very easy to figure out because of those Apis steles. And so, you know, they're prevalent, and it's no question. I don't think there's much of a question then, as far as I'm concerned, there's not much of a question as to why the idol took this shape.
It shows an image that they found honorable and powerful. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's common.
Common, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, and more than likely, even Jacob, you know, had to bury a bull. You know, more than likely he did. And by the way, that's Genesis 35:4. So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had, and the rings that were in their ears, Jacob hid them under the tabernacle tree that was near Shechem. So that, I mean, that's the whole story. That, and so, you know, that's the reason why the earrings are coupled with the calf. And the reason why, you know, the calf is, I think, the calf is what it is. And again, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of Hebrew here, and there's a lot of there's a lot of reasons why, you know, you can sit and look at the text and actually, you know, say this is why it's written. This is why it says that he took earrings and he took a tool, and he made the golden calf. Well, you know, he melted the earrings. You know, he didn't take a tool and do that. But again, more than likely, he finished it off, scoring it and things like that with a tool. And so, because authors of that day work their way backwards, they don't work forward like we do.
Mike, is there any significance to them calling it a calf and not a bull?
Well, actually, if you Deuteronomy chapter, hold on a second. Deuteronomy chapter 9, beginning in verse 13, is the restatement of this.
Is what?
Is the restatement. In other words, you know, Deuteronomy is the commentary on the rest of the Torah. And so, you know, if you look at the term here in Deuteronomy chapter 9, it is ox. Mm-hmm. It's a different word. Mm-hmm. But in Exodus, it's the word for calf. Okay, and so yeah, you have both. So take your pick. You know, you've got both. The other thing too is, you know, we look at the text and we see that we see that Moses, or, I'm sorry, we see that Aaron and the people are, you know, they're talking to each other and. You know, the Hebrew word there, you know, it could have either been the people against Aaron, came against, in other words, the people were just all riled up and now they come to the priesthood and said, you better do something for us, you better do something right now, or, you know, so, but again, that's even yeah. Hard to tell. It's hard to tell whether everybody's happy and they're all together in this thing or whether Aaron's being held hostage. And he's the one, you know, having to do it. But, you know, the people are angry at him. They're fighting. You know, it's just hard to see.
It's amazing that the author didn't say something about, it really puzzles me why Aaron did this. That bothers me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, and again, because we don't know which one, okay, so in Hebrew, you can, just like in English, you can have a word that with the exact same spelling that doesn't mean the same thing, you know, it just doesn't. And this is one of those words. It could either mean, you know, they're angry, or it can mean that they just came together. So you just can't tell.
You don't know what the situation was.
No, you don't.
Why does God call them stiff-necked?
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, every time God's people determined to go against his commandment, he called them stiff-necked. Okay. And so, you know, and so that begins to bring the question to the forefront. Did the people know that this was a graven image and they weren't supposed to be doing it? You know? And, you know, I would say that, yeah, they did know, because, you know, both in Deuteronomy chapter 9 and also in our text today, you know, God, you know, basically almost says so much. Listen, you know, again, listen to the story here. So, you know, there comes a time finally when, you know, God is seeing what's going on. And he starts talking to Moses about it. And the Lord said to Moses, go down for your people. Now, you know, at first they're God's people. Now they belong to Moses. God's saying, that's it. That's your kids, not my kid. It's your kid that's got the problem. Who you brought out of the land of Egypt. So Moses is even given credit for bringing them out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. Okay. So God is accusing them of doing something
they should have known
that I've commanded them not to do it. And how long did it take them to break that commandment? He said quickly. It wasn't long, and they broke that commandment. And it says so much, too, in Deuteronomy chapter 9. So, you know, the context of this leads us to believe that they knew better than to make an image. They knew, even though Moses is up on top of the mountain, and he hasn't brought the Ten Commandments down yet, they knew what they were. They knew they weren't supposed to be doing it. Because how else would God be able to make that kind of statement, You know, he wouldn't. He just wouldn't be able to make that statement if not. So they made for themselves the golden calf, and they worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Now, this is, I think, the most interesting thing. Because it's not like God doesn't know you inside and out. And he does. Okay? So, is God talking about the majority of the people? Is God talking about every single individual? You know, the story just doesn't go there. However, you know, in general, you know, God is saying that, okay, you have made for yourself a golden calf. You worship it, you know, not me. Okay. You worshiped it and you sacrificed to it, not me. God is saying here. And you said, "These are our gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." So, you know, in general, God is talking this way about, you know, the populace there.
But he does judge nations as a whole.
He does judge nations as a whole.
So, I agree. He knows our individual hearts.
Right, which is a good example of that is Joshua and Caleb. You know, they had to suffer with all the other people, even though they did what was exactly right. They were completely obedient and knew that God was giving them the land and knew that they could take it, but yet they had to suffer with everybody else. So,
but they did get rewarded. Mm-hmm. They got rewarded in the end.
Oh, they did. Yeah, I do agree. That kind of faithfulness doesn't come without rewards. You're right. But sometimes it's not until the end. But the point is, you know, Moses is going to gather to himself some of the Levites when he says, okay, now who's for Yahweh? And so they come, and there's a few thousand of them, and they put on swords, and they go out and start killing people. We'll deal with that next week.
Okay. Kill your family.
There you go. Yeah.
Go kill your family.
We'll deal with that next week. But the point is, God is saying in general, the general populace is building an image, worshiping it, and you know it's talked about here. Because in verse 5, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said. So Aaron, he's at least at this point, he's deep in, because he's even building an altar. He's going to sacrifice, okay? You know, that was his job, but he's building an altar to it. Bless you.
Hadn't they built an altar before right here?
Mm-hmm.
At that mountain.
Yeah, sure.
So, excuse me. And they knew how they had to be clean and how they had, there was no graven image there.
Mm-mm.
No. So why didn't, you know, they should have built an altar, not a.
Well.
Did they have the fire?
Huh?
Did they have the fire then? Like, were they looking at the fire, maybe?
Mm. Yeah. Well, all speculation.
Yeah.
You know. But, you know, it's interesting the way it's said, because Aaron says this, tomorrow there shall be a feast to the Lord, Yahweh. Okay? So, that's a big break, too, because, okay, Israel, here's your gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and, oh, I'm going to build an altar, and tomorrow we're going to have a feast to Yahweh. So, you know, that seems to be broken. Again, you know, there's just so much here that, you know, just can't settle in on. And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. So they're sacrificing correctly. Okay. They're doing that. And the people sat down to eat, drink, and rose up to play. That Hebrew there is the same exact Hebrew. You know, when Joseph was running away from Potiphar's wife, she was doing exactly the same thing and accusing him of doing it. So what it's saying here is, you know, you've found a lover.
You what?
You found a lover.
Orgies.
Yeah.
Well, look at the next one. The next picture kind of shows it, if you look.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put orgy in
there. Well, you can if you want.
40 days to go from... Yeah.
Yeah, so I have a question. So mm-hmm. do you think there's any significance to the time frame? Because the 40 days, at that point, they're saying God's not around anymore.
Right.
Had we seen that before, prior to that?
What?
Mm-hmm.
It was 40 days.
Yeah.
It was.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
For me.
The flood was 40 days.
Because I know Jesus wouldn't be until after, but I was just curious if,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about God wasn't doing what they wanted them, he wasn't showing himself the way that they wanted him to.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they just replaced him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks to a lot of what we would do. Mm-hmm. Well, God's not showing up the way that I want him to.
Mm-hmm.
He's not my vending machine God.
Right.
How do I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think there's some significance to that as well.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the pastoral notes to that would be that, you know, there's times when God's not going to be as near to you as other times.
Right.
You know, and you need to get used to that.
Yeah.
And not invent your own ways to bring him back. Because he'll come back when he comes back.
Mm-hmm. But is that because of our lack of faithfulness or something, or something we've done?
I don't think I would presume that, but because, you know, God...
He's just closer sometimes than other times.
Well, you know, it appears that, yes, that's the case, you know, that he is. He's closer at times than other times. And almost everybody has that kind of testimony in their life.
Yeah.
You know, that
I think that's a big warning to us.
Yeah.
I think so.
And so, you know, the point here is, okay, so the pastoral notes would be, okay, you can't create your own mountaintop experience because God's not going to accept it.
Yeah.
You can't orchestrate your own mountaintop experience. You know, you can't say, oh, I want it back the way it was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, I'm going to do this in order to force God. Because really, when it comes right down to it, the gods of Egypt, the gods of the ancient Near East, you know, were channeled through those idols. And, you know, did they like it all that much? Well, that's an answer that I can't give you. But the point is here... You know, you're not going to force God, you know, you're just not going to force God through things like this. You know, it happened at the Tower of Babel. We still thought we could do it. We can channel God, bring him down and make him do our dance, mm-hmm. you know. So this is exactly the same thing.
All the religious pomp and circumstance of different religions.
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah. But
I think that really tests the faithfulness of us, because if you can't create this mountaintop experience, and we know that about God, that God's going to come and show up the way he wants to show up in our lives
mm-hmm.
at different times. I mean, you know, as a human, let's say, okay, there's 5 years where you don't even feel like God's around you. Do you remain faithful? It's mm-hmm. a test of that faithfulness.
Yeah, which, you know, really... lends itself heavily to the understanding, the psalmist's understanding, be still and know that I'm
exactly.
God.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we don't feel it. I mean, and there's story after story after story in the Bible that says that God's people are like, where are you?
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, I've been here all along. You were the loser.
That's a powerful question to reflect on personally. Just how do you behave when you feel abandoned?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you turn to?
Because
the beginning of the story of we want to see God. Where is he gone? I want to be close to him. Like, that resonates very much. And then to see, okay, what do you do with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because they thought they were following God. And that's what we think.
Mm.
And then, yet, this... they feel so abandoned by him that they turn. And I just, to me, that boggles my mind, but I do the same thing, don't I?
Yes, we do.
I mean, I've done it. And even thinking along the lines of the traditional church, you see,
right,
how it creates that experience through lights and music and...
Or even imagine it starts out, they want to connect with God, and so we're going to create something to channel him. Well, then that doesn't necessarily work, so we turn to, like, they end up with orgies. Like, you eventually get to a place of, I have to meet this need somehow. This is extrapolating, but this is a really interesting section.
Yeah, it really is. And I do like the way the author leaves it wide open that, because, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation, and it rarely is a one-size-fits-all. Even in a small church, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It just isn't.
You have to be ever on alert not to follow the crowd in some situations.
I would agree. But, you know, again, if God is the leader... And I can't seem at this point in time, most likely I'm to stand still.
Be still, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just know that he hasn't abandoned me. I don't know what he's doing. I can't see what he's doing. But I'm not going to do something myself that's going to, well, conjure him up or somehow take his place. Because, well, basically what this is really saying is anything that you do is going to take his place.
Right.
Because God wouldn't have been able to, you know, accuse them the way he accused them. And we'll look at next week, we'll look at the fact that, hey, well, let's just wipe them out. We'll just start all over again. and so we don't like to think about things like that, but, you know, we've already had one reset up to this point. The flood was one reset. And God just very easily talked about a second. And so it was Moses' interaction with God that kept that from happening. Interesting. So that's where we're going to pick up next week.
That's interesting, too, that he listened to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is all kind of ironic, too, because God knows everything and knows all time. And so he already knew that was going to play out.
He did. There's no question about that.
So like, who's convincing who?
But the people are responsible for their actions.
Yeah. He's like, talking to Moses, like, go away from me. And Moses is like, he stays. He doesn't obey God.
Right.
So you question the intimacy that Moses and God have.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like Moses knows he didn't really need it.
Yeah, yeah. And not just that. I mean, how many times did God say, okay, go do that? Well, if you're not going with me, I'm not going.
Right.
I'm not going to do that. You know, so. Yeah.
I know the quiet times in my life, God is usually, and I've tried to conjure up and make him say something. He's usually come back with, well, what part of be still do you not understand? And, I mean, I've actually heard that. Or, can't you trust me with your silence, with my silence?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. And, you know, and you read Job. Job had to trust him through a whole lot of silence there, with a lot of accusations coming against him. And yet he trusted. I mean, he cried out, but he knew who to cry out to. And then on this thing, you keep saying they didn't know because they hadn't gotten the tablets yet. Isn't it possible that in Exodus 20, when God spoke, he spoke the top 10 hits aloud?
No, I'm arguing that they didn't.
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Well, listen, you kept saying
they
didn't have the tablets yet. But
right.
No, they
but no,
it.
No, yeah. I'm arguing that they did know. I mean, they knew all the way back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
But they turned it with his voice.
No, I agree. I agree, because how else would God be able to say, how quickly did you break away from what I commanded you to do? Right, exactly.
No, I thought clearly.
Yeah.
They heard his voice.
Oh, yeah. No, they knew. They knew the graven image was not the thing to do.
You know, in my old church, they used to, if we had to go to the restroom, they'd pipe the sermon in there. Could you fix that for us, please?
Sure. Sure. Okay.
Yeah. But now, back to the earrings. You know, I think about those, and we've been calling them pagan things. But in Ezekiel 16, God dresses his bride with earrings.
He does.
And those rings.
That's
and
right.
Crown and
so we're okay.
Right.
You know. Of course, in Isaiah, he says, I'm going to strip them off of you because of your disobedience.
Yeah, that's right.
So don't look at them as horrible things.
God, yeah, no, they're not.
God doesn't take children with earrings and nose rings just as what was it? Gehazi gave to Rebecca.
Yeah, right.
Nose ring, earring.
Eliezer.
Yeah, because there you go. Yeah, my names are getting all goofed up today. But, yeah, they're good things.
Yes.
God gives them to you.
They're claims. Yeah.
Yeah.
They are.
So they're like a tag that you put on the cow.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. He's, you know, I mean, in Property Ezekiel, he clearly said, I found you. I found you in the garbage heap.
Mm-hmm.
And I dressed you with nose rings and earrings and a crown on your head and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, I
so
agree.
So don't think of them as bad.
No.
However, the
not
other
always.
Religious identification was more along the lines of like when they do the, it was identifying that this is who you
A visible.
Are. A mark. Yeah.
Right.
Who you belong to. What religious, what Elohim you are worshiping.
Right.
So did the Hebrews have like traditions in their culture where they would be, outward appearance would speak about Yahweh being their God? I'm just curious.
Well, you know, that's really circumcision.
Okay.
You know, that's,
but that's
that. Yeah,
that
that's
outward?
Not no. Well, not outward enough.
I'm just curious.
And
yeah.
One type of
like
fabric and
right
tassels.
Exactly. Yeah. No. By their
clothing,
you
okay.
would know. Yes.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then their slave that wanted to stay forever.
And put
would
the
all through,
oh,
the,
yeah.
all through the ear,
saying like I belong to this family.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That. Okay.
It'd have that mark. Yes.
Uh huh. I was just curious about that. Some of the outward appearance things that they did to just mark themselves as different.
Sure.
The men were hairy
for a little while.
Mm-hmm. The men were hairy. They had beards and stuff, and the rest of the culture shaved.
That's right. Right.
Yeah. Egyptians were hairless.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yep.
That was interesting for Joseph to shave after being in prison all that time when he was going to go back and forth.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we'll pick up there. We'll finish 32, and we'll do 33 next week. So, okay.